Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by A Dozen Cousins, soulfully seasoned, ready-to-eat beans. Learn more at adozencousins.com.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, we are joined by the team from Rosella, a new sustainable sushi restaurant in New York City. We follow the journey of how they met and pushed themselves to study over 90 variety of fishes to deliver the high quality they are used to while being good stewards for the environment. And on the second half, Jocelyn McKenzie returns to Snacky Tunes to play songs from her new record, Push. She shares her methodologies for making music and tapping into the voices around us that help pull songs from the ether. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Listen up. The whole world in a flux of a fever, sent to search and destroy by the ether. Everyone's either breaking up or breaking down. Ooh. Who'd have known we would both end up smolderingly lonely? Now I've only one thought when you phone me. Will you heal me from bottom up or top down? 'Cause you make it better.
Better, 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 better
and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Brosnitz. We are back after, at least for myself, a hiatus from our book tour and book launch. Thank you to everyone who attended and to everyone who bought a book. They're still for sale. If you go to snackytunes.com, small little plug. We are joined by the team from Rosella, a sustainable sushi spot that opened in New York. If you can believe it, it opened in October 2020. Welcome, guys. Why don't you go around and introduce yourselves and what you do at the shop?
I guess I'll start. I'm Yoni Lang. First off, thank you so much for having us on. I'm very excited to be here today. I am one of the chef partners in the restaurant, so my kind of day-to-day is, you know, making the food, executing the food, menus, and whatnot. So very glad to be here.
Hey, I'm Jeff Miller, the other chef and partner.
And I'm TJ Provenzano, the third partner and beverage director.
Well, thank you for joining us. Before we get to the restaurant, let's go back a little bit. Each of you, we have varied youths, as one will. And I'm curious for each of you, what was your turning point where you knew your life was going to be committed to food, or TJ in your stance, committed to wine?
Wait, do we have to be committed already? Goodness gracious.
I think when you open a restaurant, at least like forward facing, you have to be committed. And the public that you're serving, yes.
Existential crisis commence.
Yes. Yeah. Pandemic notwithstanding. TJ, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that for me, it happened pretty early on. I was in college in Boston, working for a little Italian restaurant with a wood-fired grill, and was drinking a lot of Italian wines and learning a lot about Italian wines, and just kind of immersed myself in it at about the age of 22 or 23, and fell in love and just loved the idea of not being behind a desk every day and committing to something creative that you can, you know, really have an influence on people's good times. And, you know, living that kind of life seemed very beneficial. And I really fell in love with the whole idea of it and just kept progressing. I started working for some local producers and eventually found my way focusing on local products. So that was kind of an exciting turning point. But I would say early on, 23, 24 years old, I decided to kind of go all in, and it took that long to get where we are today, about another 15 years later. And it's all very exciting. And even the pandemic can't, you know, delay my passion for it. So it's exciting.
Yoni?
Oh, man, I would probably echo around the same age that TJ said. I had a bit of a flip-flop in career paths, I guess you'd say. I'd been racing a bicycle full-time since I was in high school, and kind of came up through going to LSU, still with that full-time bicycle racing, and actually ended up dropping out of LSU to pursue that even further. And the, I guess the creative aspect of you know, restaurants and specifically sushi was what I wanted to get into from the get-go, was just something that I was always drawn to. And I guess after, you know, getting into the restaurant industry initially and kind of deciding whether or not to go down the career path of trying to, you know, become a professional athlete or proceed in the restaurant industry, eventually picked the restaurant industry. And definitely a huge change in what you do on a day-to-day basis. But I would say, I guess around maybe 22, I moved, decided to kind of uproot my life and move away from Louisiana and go pursue that culinary lifestyle.
Jeff?
Boy, I'm not sure exactly how old I was. It was right around 2010 or 2011. I was still finishing college, I started making sushi when I was in college at the University of Florida. But I had an internship at an ad agency up in Birmingham, Alabama. And a couple weeks into the internship, I was so restless and missing restaurants. So I picked up a little side job at a burger place. Not because I needed the money or anything, but just because I missed being in a restaurant. And so right around then, I realized maybe it's time to just accept restaurants.
Yoni, I'm spending the pandemic in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is not too far from Baton Rouge.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I know you had a sushi food truck during the time. What were you serving? Where were you sourcing your fish? What could one expect on the menu?
That's definitely a blast from the past. After I kind of was still back and forth between cycling and working for free behind a sushi bar, just trying to, you know, gain the respect of peers and learn the skill set and whatnot. I guess after about a year, I thought it would be a good idea to open up a sushi truck in Baton Rouge in the middle of summer. And it was actually a fellow cyclist. His name is Patrick Fellows, and he owns a couple restaurants in Baton Rouge. One in particular was called Fresh. It was a salad shop, and they did all just very healthy lifestyle kind of foods. And he had this truck that he didn't really know what to do with. He offered it to me and said, if this is something you want to pursue, you know, you feel free to use the truck. And I put a little menu together. It was a little menu of mostly just some small rolls and some nigiri, some sashimis. And again, I'd only been in the restaurant industry for maybe a year at this point. And so it was very green still, and was kind of just figuring it out as I went. And, I actually, funny enough, I got to the point where I was pulling this truck up to bars and waiting until people filed out of the LSU bars at 2 a.m. and were serving them large rolls cut on a bias, serving them sushi burritos. And I was just selling out every night. It was hilarious. It was just a food truck with Kendrick Lamar playing, bunch of friends hanging out, helping me ring customers up and, slanging sushi out of windows. It was a blast.
Yoni, were you selling out because you didn't prep enough?
probably definitely something along those lines.
I mean, just the way you spin it, you know, sell one, sell 10, just as long as there's nothing left.
Exactly. Yeah.
Jeff, you headed to Texas to one of Darren and mine's favorite restaurant groups, Uchiko. We started as the line chef, and you made your way up to sushi chef. For the uninitiated, what is that process? And what are you allowed to touch as a line chef? And then what do you finally get your hands on as a sushi chef?
Boy, the extent of this answer could take a very long time. That trajectory and that story would be different for everyone, but the reason that I moved to Texas to work for Uchi and Uchiko was because that path was going to be so difficult and challenging and new. I had spent 5 years at a restaurant in Gainesville, Florida called Dragonfly. And then I went and staged at Uchiko and realized just how much I still had to learn after 5 years of being in sushi. And so when I got there, it was kind of like starting over. I had worked up to being a head sushi chef at Dragonfly, but yeah, going back down to line level, at Uchi and then Uchiko, really it required, setting pride aside, allowing myself to relearn a lot of basics. And then it just took years of getting through. If you've been to those restaurants, you know how busy they are. It just took years of getting through some very very difficult, busy nights, and absorbing everything that I could along the way. That's where I met Yoni. Yoni, working with Yoni got a lot out of me as well. We're both pretty competitive people. Anyway, I should stop there because Yoni can tell his side of this story. But we got a lot out of each other.
TJ, I know that you're born and raised New Yorker, not just New York City, but the state of New York. Once you shifted your focus to wine, you ended up as the general manager of Brooklyn Oenology. But that's also where the sustainable sushi experiences started. Can you give a little history of your education there and how the sushi pop-ups came about?
Absolutely. It was a really fun time. It was 2013 when we did our first Mayanoki pop-up at BOE. And the Brooklyn Oenology Tasting Room was a wonderful place right in the middle of Williamsburg, kind of right at the, I would say right in the middle of the kind of renaissance in Williamsburg, where local became such a big word to use. And, you know, things like Smorgasburg were really taking off, and it seemed like all of our neighbors and all of our competitors were thinking about how to make things local, how to take pride in what's right around the corner from you. And here in New York State, we have the ability to source, you know, everything from vegetables to seafood right in our own backyard and grow amazing wines. So taking that pride and really trying to find ways to highlight that was what we were trying to do at BOE. And the sushi program was just an extension of that. It was, you know, we were working with a couple other people that came to us and said, hey, we have some ideas about sourcing local seafood and showcasing, you know, we live on an ocean here in New York, and why not, you know, serve an omakase with when we're focusing only on New York State products and do a pairing along with it that is entirely local. And that was extremely interesting to me. It was something that we were doing maybe once or twice a month. It's kind of funny to look back and see that first menu that we put together back in 2013. You know, we were naming the dishes. I think we had the Tavern on the Green was one of the courses, and you know, it's embarrassing, but also nostalgic, and really is a good kind of jumping off point to where we've ended up now. But we really wanted to show people that right in their own backyards, you know, there are amazing things to work with, and that if you kind of limit yourself to only using those, that some creativity can really come out. And, you know, definitely steering away from the kind of traditional experience that you may expect with an omakase was really fun, and it was really interesting to offer people something that was that different. So for a few years, we were doing that maybe once or twice a month, kind of it was gaining its own steam, and it was really kind of building a name for itself. And it was funny because we'd be back serving wine and doing flights and tastings at Brooklyn Oenology, and people would show up and be like, hey, where's the sushi restaurant? You know, we're on Google and it says there's a sushi restaurant here. So I think then that's when we started to notice that this thing had a life of its own. Eventually, in 2017, we transitioned to a brick and mortar space once Brooklyn Oenology closed. And we were able to, for two solid years, offer, I think, a pretty creative and amazing omakase experience in a tiny 8-seat closet of a restaurant on 6th Street. So it was a lot of fun, and that's where Jeff and I met, and eventually Yoni and I met as well, and it took us to where we are today.
Yoni and Jeff, question for both of you. I imagine that Uchi and Uchiko just got the best fish from around the world, no questions asked. What was the gear shift or mental shift you had to do to switch over to sustainable sushi and refine your approach with those creative limitations?
Oh, man. There's so much to that, but it started, the transition started when, and Yoni, jump in if I'm missing anything here, but Yoni was the head sushi chef at Uchiko, and I was working under him. And he had me take over the fish ordering responsibility. And one of our suppliers at that time, most of our suppliers, like you said, accurately were getting us fish from all over the world, specifically from Japan. All the classic Japanese fish you're accustomed to seeing at good sushi restaurants. But we were getting, scallops and big eye tuna from Peerless, based in Brooklyn. We were getting New Jersey scallops and New Jersey tuna. And I think that's how it started. I don't even know how we got the account started with them, but the quality of the seafood they were sending was excellent. And it was so good that it challenged our preconceived notions that seafood was seafood from Japan was inherently better. So we just started exploring everything that this one company had to offer from the East Coast. We were getting a lot of, we just started trying any fish that they had available. And most of it was East Coast. Occasionally we'd be getting some West Coast seafood as well. Once you start down that path and you have a good supplier, you realize pretty quickly that, where the fish comes from doesn't matter as much as whether it's in season, how it's caught, how it's handled, how fresh it is.
Even just having that good supplier, you know, someone who really cares on their side of the industry is so rare, and it's as rare as, you know, finding a good worker in any industry. And so, building those relationships throughout the years has been very important. I know Jeff has spent a lot of time building a lot of the relationships so he can, get good fish. And like you said, once we went down this path of realizing that, the things we were seeing, so to speak, in our backyard, was almost superior in terms where we wasn't spending as much time in the air on an airplane. And especially more important when you are getting fish off of boats that are really caring for how they're bringing it in, and the fish isn't being kept on the line for too long. So it's all these factors are so important before you even get the fish that a lot of times you have no control over. So having that person who really cares about, the industry from the fish purveyor point of view is super important for us.
Oh man. Yeah. To that point, I remember shortly after we started ordering a lot of seafood from Peerless, I switched where we were getting tuna from one week. I switched our tuna supplier because the tuna that Peerless had shipped was, not as good as we wanted. And we were going into service and I checked my phone and I had 5 missed calls from our rep from Peerless. And I thought it was some sort of emergency. So I called him back and he was like, "Hey man, I just want to know why you didn't order tuna from us this week." And I explained it to him and he said, "Oh dude, please let me know." It sounded like he was desperate, but he just cared so much. He wanted to make sure that we were getting exactly what we wanted. And you don't get that from every company. And that makes a hell of a difference when you're working with people who care. And to elaborate on this one more point that, to make from something that Yoni and I discovered the first time we went to Japan is, yes, Japanese fish are good for sushi. But I don't think we could have realized this until we were in Japan together. The first time was in 2016, and then all three of us went together in 2019. But the fish that the Japanese ship to us or ship outside of Japan, all that fish has been picked over quite a bit. So if you're in Texas, you're not getting the the best of the best from Japan.
We're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to play a song from our archives, and then we'll be back with the team from Rosella here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Before we get to the restaurant itself, I think a good complement to your own education is guest education. And you have, you know, sustainable sushi restaurant within the name, and you're pushing it not just as an angle, but as something you obviously all deeply believe in. What goes into the guest education side who have either maybe not been curious about another way of having sushi or feel that sushi is only done a particular way? TJ, we'll start with you.
I think it's a great question. I can tell you that when we were at Myanoki and we were having those kind of one-on-one indoor experiences, it was a lot easier. We were able to really kind of interact with guests in a way that could kind of, they could get out of it what they came to get out of it. If somebody came and they had all the questions in the world and they really wanted to, you know, understand the restaurant and understand our philosophy behind the restaurant, we could give that to them in their, you know, 2-hour dinner experience. It has been a lot more difficult, I would say, since opening Rosella to do that in, you know, in the current state of restaurants in New York City. We are unable to have guests inside, as you know, and it's a lot more difficult, I think, to relay this information through the internet or through, you know, an app, you know, a screen on somebody's phone. Or in the freezing cold. So I think our tasting menu experience is really the best way for us to relay that to guests and to get that information in front of them, and also to explain the story behind everything, which I think is so important, especially with, you know, not only with the sushi, but with our wines. You know, every wine has a story, everything has a background to it, and it's much more enjoyable when you understand all the intricacies and, you know, all of the kind of thought and curation that's gone into selecting those products or, you know, aging the fish in certain ways, et cetera, et cetera. But that's been one way that we've had to pivot, you know, since this all started. And I think that, you know, it's something that we look forward to having the traditional experience back in our hands so that we can relay that information a little bit better. And we can, you know, talk about the things that get us so excited about doing what we do. It's certainly been a challenge to do that recently. But I think we're all kind of internally super excited about getting back to that and finding better ways to do that in its current, you know, in the current state of things as well.
Yoni, I know you have a background in a strong background in fermentation and preservation, which is so key to sustainability and seasonality. How does that play into the menu creation and what's going on the plate? And how are you also kind of getting customers to not maybe fall in love with something that might disappear in a couple weeks?
Man, that is the puzzle that, you know, we're constantly trying to figure out, so to speak. That's an amazing question. I mean, that is so important with what we do on a day-to-day basis, whereas, you know, our fish, which is all ordered seasonally and utilized at the best possible time that we perceive it to be. you know, the same goes for fruits and vegetables. And, you know, moving up to New York has definitely thrown a nice curveball, you know, in this direction to figure out new seasons, figuring out even growing things myself. We've been super fortunate to be able to have a little greenhouse over in Brooklyn on top of Rooftop Reds that we were able to grow some herbs and, you know, vegetables and fruit and utilize a lot of those things. And, you know, a lot of that just goes back to, I think for Jeff and I, the most important thing was creating a library of sorts for us to go back to. You know, working in a lot of restaurants, you tend to ignore seasonality and you get these product lists from all over the world, you know, South America, and then from Northern America, you're getting a lot of stuff from the West Coast that isn't in season, and that can really kind of stifle that creative process, in my opinion, because, you know, looking at a list of every ingredient imaginable versus this is what we have to work with, you know, restricting yourself a little more and saying, you know, let's do everything possible that we can do with this one ingredient. Take mushrooms, for example. Can we dry them, roast them, and dry them, pickle them, and dry them, pickle them, and keep them pickled, ferment them, pickle them with another vegetable? I mean, the possibilities are really endless. Turn it into a powder, turn it into a, you know, a chili powder, whatever you wanted to do. You can get so many possibilities out of one component. So I think from the get-go, our plan was always to kind of create this archive of ingredients that were preserved that we can go back to and say, hey, let's, you know, it's been very cold lately, kind of missing the summer. Let's put some pickled strawberries on this dish from the summer, you know? And then you kind of, the creative process becomes a little more intuitive, and it just becomes a lot more fun than, you know, really just creating, having to create something from every possible, you know, option. And it's been amazing. You know, I learned a lot from a chef in Dallas, Texas, Joel Orsini. I was able to work at a small little restaurant with him. We were the two employees in this kitchen, and we had a huge garden on the roof that we took care of. We had a beehive up there that we took care of. Of caring immensely about the importance of, you know, buying things locally and growing, and not just buying things locally, but even, you know, growing things yourself so you can give that to your neighbors to use for things. And the zero waste format is not restricted to simply what you can do with it, but what, you know, what you can give to other people. And that's where I think we're going to see the most growth, I think.
I know that some of our listeners are like, hey, yeah, that's great. Sounds amazing. Must be nice. New York City. How wonderful. And like really roses, guys. Like, that's awesome. But there has to be some difficulties. I don't want to use the word downside, but difficulties to this approach. And Jeff, maybe from a culinary standpoint, you know, what are some of the just real honesties about some hardships that you have to face and endure along the way by taking this approach?
The most of those difficulties, I think we experienced and got through early on, and they reflected, I think, an underdeveloped approach to what we were doing. Those specific difficulties being trying to create menus that we were comfortable with out of ingredients that we were uncomfortable and unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. So at first we were trying to make menus we normally have tuna on the menu and we normally do this with it, but there's no good tuna around. There's no good sustainable local tuna. So what can we use in its place for the same sort of dish? And those dishes would end up being inferior to what we would make with the fish that we were used to. And so when things started to really improve, it was when we adopted a mindset that was embracing what we had for what it is, rather than trying to find substitutes. And there was a part of that inevitably required a lot of time and work, familiarizing. When TJ and I were running Mayanoki on 6th Street, I calculated this before we opened Rosella. I calculated this because I kept track of every menu that we made. We used 91 unique species of fish and shellfish at Mayanoki. And so the process of familiarizing ourselves with each one of those was work. But now on the other side of it, things are becoming a little more automatic in that regard.
It's incredible. TJ, I know that you've run everything through a local New York lens for your beverage pairing. Mm-hmm. What can I say to my snobby natural wine only from France, you know, 12 bottles a season if you're lucky, mm-hmm. drinking sure. friends that you know, you're missing out in New York, and like, you definitely want to get your hands on this because it's wonderful on its own, but it's delicious with sushi.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that comes up often, as Yoni and Jeff have to put up with me talking about all the time. But you know,
yeah, I'm waiting for the swearing.
we love those wines. It's a podcast. Those wines, you know, we love those wines. I love Old World wines. They are absolutely, you know, some of the greatest wines in the world, and you won't find me objecting with that ever. We're trying something new here. We're trying something different, and I really enjoy embracing new concepts when I go to visit other restaurants, and I love when people do the same when they come to visit ours. A lot of the wines that are on our list are definitely off the beaten path. You know, the whole, it's a very conceptual list, with a hard line taken, you know, on using only domestic and, you know, really trying to showcase kind of even the underserved regions within the United States. So not just focusing on California and Oregon, which, you know, you may expect from an all-American wine menu, but really, you know, showcasing some of the other underappreciated regions of the United States. And it's our way of showing that, you know, of continuing the local concept, right? We're trying to cut down our carbon footprint and trying to highlight, you know, what's being done in our own backyards, quote unquote. But it's also an opportunity for us to, you know, to really give the backstory and to give the entire experience behind each bottle. You know, some of these, productions that we have on our list are, you know, 100 cases produced in total. It's not that, you know, you're only able to get your hands on one case. It's that there's only 100 cases made of the thing. So, you know, having those really small batch wines, that are, you know, kind of eye-opening and really an expression of a new kind of terroir that you may be unfamiliar with, is, you know, really at the heart of our concept at Rosella, is that, you know, we're definitely trying something different. We're definitely trying to open people's eyes to something that may be uncomfortable at first. Some of our wines definitely are, they're aggressive, you know, they're definitely wines that are trying to, you know, put themselves on the map. And the entire menu that we've put together for our wine list is all about the food, is really entirely based on trying to pair it well with seafood. At Maionokke, obviously, we were hyper-focused on local. It was entirely New York State, which was very fun to do. I can't think of another restaurant that would do an all New York State wine list, or has, you know, since or in the past. But having that focus was a lot of fun, and it was really a great way for us to show, you know, that if the seafood is coming locally, you know, these vegetables are grown locally, these, you know, all of the accoutrement that we're using, from, you know, soy sauce to wasabi, is from the United States. You know, it's a great way to show that if it grows together, it goes together, which is something I've said way too much in the past 5 years or so, but it really is true. And it's at the heart of exactly what we do. And, you know, trying to open up new space. And so to the wine drinkers that are used to their Premier Crus and that's what they'd like, you know, there's no harm in that. And obviously those are amazing wines, but when you come to Rosella, you know, we're trying something new, and we're trying to show you that, hey, we have a Piquette from Maryland on our list that I think, you know, with some of these aggressive flavors that these guys are working with is just amazing. And it's really fun. And it's something that I don't think you'll see everywhere. You know, now opening it up to the rest of America has been wonderful. You know, we at Maionokke was all New York State. Now we're in the entirety of the United States. So we have even more to play with. And right now, as you can imagine, since we just opened, we, you know, our list is hyper conceptual. It's our, you know, our coming out list. It's what we wanted to kind of drop as our opener. Like, this is Rosella. This is our passion, and this is where we are. And you know, as we'll evolve the list a little bit as time goes on, and we get our, you know, we settle in and we serve these wines and sell out of them. It really can't be the same thing twice, because again, some of these wines are 100, 200 cases produced. So it will constantly be changing, and it'll always be different. So I would say, you know, to the upper echelon of wine drinkers, to give it a try and to keep trying it, you know, again and again, because it will always change. It will always adapt. And that's at the heart of sustainability, is that you have to be flexible and keep moving forward.
It's not just a beautiful wine list and a beautiful menu, but the space itself is stunning. We know that our good friends, former guests of Snacky Tunes, Anna Polonsky from Polonsky and Friends, had involvement in it, but for those who have not gotten a chance to lay their eyes on it, can you describe the room a little bit and how it embodies what your approach is to the food and the drink?
I think that, you know, Anna Polonsky was absolutely amazing to work with. She did an amazing job, you know, getting across a very modern vibe that, you know, has kind of an homage to a Japanese tasting menu room without going overboard and without trying to be something that we're not. And I think that her choices for colors and the deep woods that she chose are amazing. And I think that she really got the vibe of the three of us and, you know, how we wanted to display our restaurant. I think she did an amazing job, and she was phenomenal to work with. I think that we really can't wait for people to come inside and see it one day.
The design itself is, it reflects our love of eating at bars. It's entirely bar seating. There's a 6-seat sushi bar in the back and about 12-seat wine bar in the front. So if in under normal circumstances, no matter where you're sitting, you're facing the center of the restaurant and you're seeing the people at the opposite bar eating and drinking. The part of that is that that's how we love to eat, but we also designed it that way to create as much energy in the small space as possible. and on a enhance that in ways that we would not have been able to think of ourselves, which I guess is the reason you hire a designer.
Yes. Last question, quick fire to all three of you. Yoni, we'll start with you. What is the greatest takeaway you've gotten from refining your approach through sustainability? What is kind of the best lesson or biggest change in the way in which you see the world while adopting these new type of limitations for the better?
I think the most important thing is to really not see them as limitations, but more as opportunities to really enhance your business, and to really, like you said, you know, refine the craft. It's definitely not an easy time. You know, being in this neighborhood is amazing and the best place we could have picked, you know, specifically because, you know, so many people in this neighborhood are keen to try new things and support local. And, you know, we really want to cement ourselves in this neighborhood and be that neighborhood spot that we can continue to, you know, provide people with new, creative and exciting food. And, you know, we do it for the guests and, you know, we definitely love what we do and, working with these guys and this team that we have. You know, we have a very small team, 5-person crew. You have to look at everything as a potential opportunity as opposed to a limitation. And, I couldn't be prouder of the team that we have and what everyone does. And when everyone shows up to work, you know, everyone shows up to work and it's all for this neighborhood and, you know, for ourselves and doing something that we're proud of. And, you know, it's a super exciting opportunity. It makes me so happy to be able to be here and to meet new people and to be a part of this neighborhood.
TJ?
I would say that what I've taken away from it that's been the most beneficial is just that commitment. You have to make that commitment to doing it a different way. And once you make that commitment and it's, you know, can I use this because it'll make it taste better? No, you can't, because you've made the choice to live this way. It's not always the easy choice, but it always feels better. And, you know, echoing what Yoni said, these are opportunities for you to get creative and really expand what you thought that you were capable of in order to get something accomplished. And that's a very rewarding part of thinking through a sustainable lens is, you know, you get to decide how well this comes out by your own ingenuity. And when you do that and you make that commitment to think about it that way, it really is rewarding and worth it every time.
And Jeff?
I think the decision that we've all made to embrace sustainable seafood and wines and practices in general prepared us really well for what we're in the midst of right now. You have to be adaptable if you're working with products that are ever changing and not what you're accustomed to. You have to, in the same way you embrace sustainability, you have to embrace being adaptable. And we've, since March, we've sustainability at this point is a given. But we've had to become adaptable in ways that we hadn't foreseen. And I think we've been able to do a better job because it's become ingrained in us now, being adaptable.
Well, I want to thank the three of you for taking time on your day off to speak with us. Where can people find you? How can they follow you, get to go, make reservations? Where can they get you?
TJ, you want to take that?
Hey, we are we're on Avenue A between St. Mark's and 9th Street in the East Village of New York City. Our website is rosellanyc.com. You can find us on all the normal social media channels on Instagram and Facebook.
Do we have a Facebook?
I think so. Maybe not. I certainly don't have a Facebook page, so I don't know. But we're definitely at Rosella Sushi on Instagram. That's a fact. We're open for dinner right now and takeout and delivery as we, you know, pivot in this pandemic. And
we're also opening for lunch soon.
Yeah, indeed. Lunch this coming weekend, which we're excited about. We'll start, 11:30 to 3 for noodles and laksa and some of these other amazing kind of warming dishes in the wintertime. And, the three of us will be on Avenue A every day. So we'd love to see you over there. We're open Wednesday through Sunday right now. Definitely stop by the website or check out our Instagram because, we'd love to keep showing you what we're working on.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us. We're going to take another quick musical break with a song from our archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
It's the way it has to be. Long ago, a demon took my headache, dug a hole and placed it in. And pins it to his waistcoat. Homeward bound, he trades it for a banknote. Try to intellectualize that Cartesian flame, now pick a place to conquer. Mark the space with oil and with water. Is that all that you have to show for it? What would you know? What would you know about it anyway? Blame it on the way that God made me, here to say that it's the way it has to be. Are all that I am after. What would you know? What would you know? What would
This episode is brought to you by A Dozen Cousins, soulfully seasoned, ready-to-eat beans. A Dozen Cousins aims to bring families delicious and easy-to-prepare food inspired by traditional Creole, Caribbean, and Latin American recipes. From their Cuban black beans, made with onion, garlic, and bell peppers, to their Mexican cowboy beans made with green chilies and jalapenos, all the beans from A Dozen Cousins use easy-to-recognize ingredients like beans, vegetables, and nutrient-dense avocado oil while avoiding GMOs and artificial flavors. Learn more at adozencousins.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Jocelyn McKenzie back after an eight-year hiatus. You were on previously with Pearl and the Beard. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes.
Hi, Greg. How are you? It's been a while.
Yes. I think it's like early 2013 when we last spoke.
I was actually searching in my emails, and I think you're 100% right. So your memory is fantastic.
Oh, I cheated. I went back and listened to our episode. And I have two notes from there. One is you gave full eye contact during all of your performances.
Was that a good note or like a avoid this woman kind of a note?
I think it's just a note. And then the other thing I had is I remember your episode particularly because the three of you, you and your two bandmates, were just so charming throughout the whole thing.
And I have nothing to say to that. It's Charm City, USA over here.
So for those who want to take a quick pause and go back to episode 146 in our archives to hear kind of the prologue to this, please do. But in the interest of putting a button on it, how did the band wrap up?
Well, thank you for asking about that. You know, Pearl and the Beard, we had so much fun together. You're right. And, we enjoyed charming the pants off of each other. You know, it just turned that we had been at it for a really long time. And, you know, when you get into your 30s and you've been, you know, a band for almost a decade, suddenly, you know, you can find yourself wanting different things. So we all just were in different places with what we wanted out of our lives. And the best decision for everyone was just to part ways. And so now, you know, Jeremy, our guitar player, he has a lovely wife and family with a beautiful child. And Emily, our cello player, she, you know, is still making tons of music. Jeremy is too, actually, but Emily had done a lot of cello playing on Broadway, and you know, she was doing her thing, and as well as, of course, you know, writing and improvising. And you know, I've been working on my album really ever since then. So we all stay in touch. We're all good friends. We just, you know, that just wasn't what we were doing as a group anymore.
It's super interesting. We've done this show long enough now to have, you know, bands and performers come back in different iterations. What was the, you touched on, but like, what was the feeling when you knew that it was done to call it?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. Well, it was heartbreaking because, you know, we had been working on our last album Beast for a while, and, you know, we just knew that the parameters of it wasn't going to allow us to tour. So I was really sad that we were going to kind of release an album and not be able to tour on it. But that just ended up being the timing of what worked best for everyone. So yeah, of course it was heartbreaking and very sad for me. I can't speak to the other two. But you know, the fact that we went out with such a huge blowout show, you know, we oversold Bowery Ballroom by like 150 tickets. People flew in from literally all over the world to see our last show. And that alone, that experience was so moving to me that I had to walk away just so grateful and, you know, counting my blessings for all of the amazing people that we've met and the places that we've been able to go over the years. And, you know, so it was bittersweet, but man, what a tremendous farewell we were given.
Do you remember how that night ended? Like what time and where you were and who you were with?
I do. I remember we were starting to get nudges from our tour manager, Steven, because the venue was going to have to start charging us for overtime for all of their employees who were going to have to keep working super late. So he was like, okay, you guys, you have to wrap it up. It's time to go. So it was nearing 2:33 in the morning by the time I got back to Brooklyn. And Steven drove me home and dropped off my stuff and the last of the merch. And I just was like alone in my room in my apartment. And my roommates at the time, I had just met them and kind of just recently moved in with them right before that show. So they didn't know anything about me. So it was kind of amazing because I was able to go home with zero fanfare and just I passed out and I slept so soundly that night, but it was an incredibly late night. People were having to, like, you know, be forced out of the venue because everyone just wanted to stay and hang and sing along. And it was quite a party. And then actually the next day we realized we weren't going to get to say hi to everyone at the show. So the next day we just had a meetup spot in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg. And we were like, okay, everyone just like come to this bar all day long. We're going to be there to say goodbye, you know, especially people who came from out of town. So it was like a family reunion. It was fantastic.
One of the things that was really of note in the episode was how you all took turns crafting songs, writing lyrics. How did you begin to unwind that process mentally and then find your own voice, your own songwriting, your own style mm-hmm. as the time separated you from the band into your own solo project?
Oh, Greg, that's a really good question. I've been writing as a solo artist really my whole life. So as a writer, I kind of was just continuing to do what I had always done. You know, writing with Pearl was its own experience because, you know, I would have my songs that I would write on my own and then we would come together and have our own writing process with the three of us. So I didn't really lose anything there in my writing process. But in terms of actually bringing the songs to life and performing them and recording them, I am not really an instrumentalist. I don't consider myself one. And so working on Push, it was really an incredible thing to call in different string arrangers to record string quartet arrangements of every song. So there are actually five composers who made Push and with me, and Emily is actually one of them. And Emily plays cello in the string quartet on the album. So she was hugely integral to the process of making this. And yeah, so it was just amazing to get to, you know, have these songs kind of in the bank and then hand them over to the composers and say, do whatever you want with them and then give them back to me. And that was an amazing collaboration because I got to just, again, like let go of the reins. And then whatever they got back to me, that's what it was. You know, I made a few changes here and there, but for the most part, we kept it pretty much exactly what they wanted to hear. And it allowed this collaborative voice to shine in a way that really supported me as a writer, but gave the songs completely new life.
Did you find that any of the songs changed meaning when they got handed back to you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Particularly the Brave Ones, which I'll play a ukulele version of shortly. That song, when I handed the demo off to Sam McCormley, who was my kind of right-hand man on the project, he was my co-producer and wrote four of the string arrangements. And he did all the beats on the album. That demo was really like chirpy and, you know, kind of upbeat and, you know, this melodic little number. And Sam turned it into this like dark, swampy, minor key beast of a song. And it just blew me away. Like it totally gave it a new personality to me, which was such a powerful moment. But yeah, we had a lot of moments like that on the record, which was great.
Can we hear a song?
We can hear a song. I was just talking about the Brave Ones. I wasn't going to start with it, but I can.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. I'm going to just adjust my mic, and I'm going to do my little trick and put a little reverb on this so it sounds extra nice. You hear
Perfect.
That?
Very nice.
Oh, all yeah.
Right. Here we have Jocelyn McKenzie live on Snacky Tunes.
Spend my days eating peaches and the sand. Ain't no better way to occupy this tiny space I've been given between the sun and the land. Heard the oxen braying. You know the pretty ones who yearn to be a man. I said, well, it is not half bad. Despite zero defenses from the cold, we'll be the brave ones and thrive out of earshot of what was. Depression in your head, a Palms, palmistry, the arc of head and heart and crow's feet aside. I never open somebody's eyes, give you little kisses until the fishes come and learn to rule the land. Honey, well, it is not that bad, you know. Despite our greatest efforts, we get old. We'll make depraved love. I have a geisha in my love. We'll be the brave ones. 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 Monday, come and you shave my head again. That old domestic grime and orbit and a new babushka arrive. A century of silence gone by, little Julia. I'll take you fishing by the reservoir sometime. Your brother, your cousin, some peaches and mine. The dream of love will happen in the snow. We'll be the brave ones. We'll be the brave ones. We'll be the brave ones.
One of the other through lines from Pearl and the Beard, and now your new project, is one Ani DiFranco, who I have to admit is one of my all-time favorites from when I was in high school to 25 years later. I believe Pearl opened up for her and then she joined you on your EP. How did the relationship form?
Well, we were introduced by Ani by our old booking agent, Susie Jiang, from then she was working with Fleming Artists, who also booked Ani. So Susie suggested us as an opener for Ani, and we ended up opening for her, I think it was 26 times over the course of several years. And we just really clicked. I mean, you know, her fans were incredible and her team was incredible, but she's an incredible human being. I mean, the first time I met her, when I looked in her eyes, I was like, she can see my soul. Like, I just was convinced that she could see through my body and into my spirit. And I think when you have an experience like that, you know, you kind of just, I don't know, for me, I guess I just get really humbled to it and open up my heart a little bit more. So it was easy to take risks around her. You know, it was easy to try new songs on the road with her, and her fans were so amazing, and she was so supportive that it just became a friendship very quickly. And, you know, when I knew that it was going to be our last round of touring with her, one of the last nights, I was like, okay, well, this is the last chance I'm probably going to ever get to ask her this. But I just kind of went up to her and I was like, hey, would you ever want to write a song together? And she was like, yeah, sure. Send me something that you're working on. And I couldn't believe it. She was just like, so game, you know. I was like, okay. So I sent her some demos and she ended up contributing a bridge to my song Centenarian. And that just felt like, oh my God, like I had the biggest boost of confidence in the world, where one of the, like, a legacy artist was interested in working with me. It was just so humbling and just got me really excited to just keep making more stuff. And so as Push developed, I just kind of kept her in the loop. And then eventually she agreed to put it out on Righteous Babe. And I'm so grateful.
You lead your own songwriting courses, intuitive songwriting. I'm curious, when you work with such an icon like her,
what does she bring to the process? Is she guiding you? Is she just giving you the bridge? You know, how does she allow you to level up or come down to you, but you don't feel overshadowed by who she is and her legacy?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, in our case, you know, we really only collaborated on that one song. So I can't say that it's, you know, an ongoing thing for sure. But, you know, in that case, she just kind of sent me this brilliant additional part to a song that only really had a verse and a chorus, and she sent in this bridge, and I was like, that's perfect, it's fine. But especially with new songwriters and using our intuition to touch on songwriting as a craft, I think it's really important not to think about career or legacy or levels or anything like that, because music is our universal birthright. You know, we all have songs in us. We all have music in us. We can all sing. Talent is not a part of it for me. Talent is something that we can hone. It's something we can work on. But music and singing and songwriting are their own really very important things to me as a human being. So I know that she supports that, you know, so that alone was enough to know that she was my peer in that way, that, you know, music is something that we used for a spiritual connection with other people. And when I say spiritual, I don't necessarily mean religious by any means. I just mean that it's not material. You know, it's like when you give someone the gift of a song, that's something that stays with them forever. So I can't say that, you know, any kind of, I wasn't intimidated. I just was like so excited to meet a kindred spirit in that realm.
For the listeners who don't know about Righteous Babe, I highly encourage you to look up the history, the artist model, why it was so incredible, when it was founded, when it was, and what it, the freedom that it allowed Ani and all the artists afterwards. What does it mean to you to join a label with such pedigree and to find to have that as your home?
Oh my gosh, Greg, like you were saying earlier, you know, I wanted to be on Righteous Babe since I was a teenager.
What?
I mean, I know it's really true. It's really true. And I have to say, and I, if Ani hears this, I'm sorry. I was a little bit more in the Tori Amos camp when I was a teenager in terms of fandom, I would say. I was familiar with Ani's music and I really loved it. But I loved her legacy of being an independent entrepreneur and complete indestructible wayfinder even more than I loved her music. You know, I liked her songs and I loved her guitar playing. I truly admired her independent spirit, and all of those things put together created this amazing wave of just, she just paved the way for so many independent artists, and we're not all even aware of the work that she did. And it wasn't even out of like, you know, now that I've gotten to know her a little bit, I can't even say that and this is my speculation here, but I can't say that she was like, and now I'm going to change the world. You know, like, I think she was just doing her thing and it just kind of happened that way. I mean, like, she probably maybe at some point also said, yeah, I'm going to go, because she wanted things to be different. You know, things were, things in the record label industry and even still today, you know, are really questionable. And so to work with Righteous Babe was a dream, because I was like, they have the ethics that I want to embody as an artist, where it's like, music is for everyone. This is not a cool kids show. This is not a popularity contest. This is about getting good music into the hands of listeners who really care about what they're listening to. And all of Ani's fans are like that. And I hope to get to connect with more of them, because these are such passionate listeners, and it's just an incredible thing to be a part of this group of musicians. And particularly now, there's so many amazing artists on Righteous Babe right now. Gracie and Rachel, Resistance Revival Chorus, like all these amazing, powerful artists. It's just so humbling to be a part of that roster.
I have a daughter that just turned one, and I cannot wait to start playing her records for her, along with accompanying lyric sheets, to give her a path of like your own voice and your own unique identity. So it is so exciting for you to be there and have found it a home. Can we hear another song?
Oh, we can. Sure thing. Well, I'm going to switch now to my Omnicord. And actually, can you hear my heater? It just started going on.
It's just like a nice accompaniment.
Okay, great. You know, so we have a little heater percussion then.
It's a very real COVID time recording. So
exactly. All right, here we go. This song is called Better. This is my Omnicord. Can you hear it?
Oh, yes.
Listen up. The whole world's in the flux of a feeling.
river, sent to search and destroy by the ether. Everyone's either breaking up or breaking down. Who'd have known we would both end up smolderingly lonely? Now I've only one thought when you phone me. Will you heal me from bottom up or top down? 'Cause you make it better, 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 better. You make it better, 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 better. You make it better, 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 better than it was. Simmer down, no one said a thing about forever. But I need you right now more than ever. Praise and thanks to the space-time continuum that it's always now. 'Cause you make it better, 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 better. You make it better, 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 better. You make it better, 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 better than it was. We have all lost it, battle before, and we can't stand to lose anymore. But if we don't let go and get vulnerable, then fear will have won the whole war. That's no victory that I can afford. You and I have been mutual blessings for ages, on with staff with which notes on what pages. The melody to a song gonna get written down. Anyhow, we will come out the other side smiling. And I'm grateful you're here and you're trying. Oh, let's go for it, bottoms up and top down. 'Cause you make it better, 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 better. You make it better, 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 better. You make it better and 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 better.
So many people might not know this about you, but you are a medium.
Yes, I am.
And I had to look this up because I knew the word clairvoyance, but I did not know the word clairaudience. Oh. So can you explain to people what that is and how you use it in your songwriting practice?
Oh, thank you so much for asking. Yeah, so psychic and medium are kind of two different things. Psychic is really talks about the extension of our physical senses. So in the same way that, you know, we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, we have extensions of these senses in kind of an extra sensory way. So like clairvoyance is equivalent to like, I saw a vision, right? And you hear that, you know, people talk about that. But when you would hear someone say, oh, I heard a little voice, or, you know, a song came into my brain out of nowhere, that's called clairaudience. You know, spiritual touching is like clairsentience, you know, just knowing something is claircognizance. So the psychic senses have really informed my writing for a very long time, because when we get quiet enough to listen, for me, in my experience, there's music everywhere. So I'm really just kind of listening to what is already there and then trying my best to go through a physical process of expressing it out loud. The Brave Ones that I played earlier was an experience like that, where I just heard that whole song, really. Like, I didn't really do much. I was just in the shower and all of a sudden this words and melody just came together. Actually, Better too, the chorus to Better. I'm just kind of hearing it and then singing it out loud. So This is something that we can all practice if you're interested in it. I believe that everyone has access to these senses, and it's not, you know, it's not a magical power. It's nothing extraterrestrial. It's a very human thing that I experience in a very real way. And I love listening to the songs that are outside of me, because then I get to become the translator and hopefully collaborate with, you know, whoever might be sending them from wherever they are, and, you know, do a little co-collaboration with other realms. It's kind of great.
For those who might not have known they've experienced it, or maybe had an inkling at it, because so many artists and creatives talk about they don't actually even know where they got things from, that their hand was just moving, or they opened their mouth and the lyrics were there. To the best of your ability, when it's happening, how can you describe it? Or what does it feel like, so people can begin to look for it?
Oh, what a great question. Oh, I would say the experience is just a lot like when you meet someone for the first time and you feel like you've known them forever. And you just kind of fall into conversation just very naturally, and you don't even question it. And you find yourself talking as if you're picking up from where you left off with an old friend. And you actually have to like check in with someone and be like, wait, we just met, right? You know, that's what it feels like when a song comes in to my ear or into my brain in a clairaudient way, you know, and then I get to just kind of make friends with it and go, oh, you're visiting me right now, you know, on Tuesday at 3 p.m. while I'm at the grocery store. Okay, great. And then, you know, try and get to know it a little bit and catch up, you know, it's like, then you have to catch up like, okay, well, what have you been doing? How do you want to sound? But yeah, it's definitely something that everyone has access to. And I think another example is like, you know, when you're thinking of a friend and then they call you, or, you know, you just have a little hunch in the back of your head, you know, I should take my umbrella today, even though there's not a cloud in the sky. And then later that day it rains, you know, it's like those instinctual knowing that, you know, I think it's so easy to silence and, you know, call ourselves like, oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, it's not that big of a deal. Oh, that's not real. That's just me. But like, no, it's real. And why not follow it, you know, see where it can lead you. My imagination isn't that exciting. So when stuff like that comes in, I get very excited that I have an opportunity to get new information.
Incredible. Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song. Push is out. By the time this airs, it will have come out on Righteous Babe Records. Where can people find you, stream the record, check you out, follow you along with you, sign up for your classes?
Ooh, thank you. Yes, well, all of my stuff, the music is going to be available on righteousbabe.com. And I am on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter as Jocelyn McKenzie, spelled M-C-K-N-Z. So Jocelyn M-C-K-N-Z. And I'm also on Patreon. And Patreon is where I'm exploring some more, you know, in-depth looks at the work and, you know, sharing some card readings and meditations and kind of crossing over between music and making and mediumship and all the different things I do. Patreon is a great place to find that. And that's Patreon / Jocelyn McKenzie.
One last thing you said is life is a song that must be played by all for all. For those of us who cannot carry a tune or play a musical instrument, how do we live this sentence to its fullest?
I would say to trust. To just trust. You know, I think it was Maya Angelou said something like a bird. I should really memorize this quote, but it's like a bird doesn't sing because it has a message. A bird sings because it has a song. You know, and when I can trust that I am a human being just trying to figure out what it's like to live in this world, and music can actually help guide me to that, it helps me connect with other people and to connect with myself. You know, and anybody else's idea of what talent or success is really none of my business. So I get to stay out of that and just stay where the joy is. And music is where the joy is for me.
Incredible. I want to thank the team from Rosella who joined us earlier in the show. Thanks for listening this week. We will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. What are you going to take us out with?
I'm going to play Beam of Light from Push, which was inspired by going to a show from my friend Jason Anderson. Music inspires music inspires music.
Thank you. Let's hope it's not 8 years again before we connect. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great. with a little heater for background too. Oh, I'm gonna tune here.
Oh, tuning patter. We had this joke 8 years ago.
I know, right? And meanwhile, I didn't even play any instruments 8 years ago.
Oh my, oh.
What did I play, like a shaker probably?
Something like that. Very charming though. No one even noticed.
I barely play instruments now, so we're doing our best here. Okay, here we go. This is Beam of Light.
As I turned to leave, you looked me right in the eye and said, hey, let's keep talking about art and life. We walked to the train, I took your hand and I said, let's listen to the sounds of the city again. And I don't understand the pain of being awake, awake, awake. But I know that somehow we will all be together as a beam of light one day. You broke three strings, you were hard on yourself, but it really didn't matter to anyone else. You shared truth, love, and hurt, you shared weird light and dirt, and it all made the pattern of my favorite quilt. And I don't understand the joy of being awake, awake, awake. But I know that somehow we will all be together as a beam of light one day. Oh, my hands are shaking, but my belly is full, and there's nowhere else I'd rather be than making memories with you. You're the king of misfits and heartsick vagabonds and the latter-day scholars who all get along. Of course we'll remember and of course it will fade, a story as sacred as it is profane. As we all bear our chest to the thick orange sky, we will never be the same. Just for a moment, we all shared a body as a beam of light that day. It is pain, it is joy, it is you that keeps me awake, awake, awake. You are the love that will hold us together as a beam of light one day. Oh, I know that somehow we will all be together as a beam of light one day.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.